greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on drought in America when we come back. Well, let me ask you this. What do you think's wrong with the Ten Commandments? It's pretty obvious that something is wrong with the Ten Commandments because they've been banned from our public schools. They're banned from our public institutions. They have been removed from our national consciousness. Now, instead of these 10 simple, time-tested laws, we see the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in their place, and they teach the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in our public schools, our public institutions. We've made them a part of our national psyche. You know, this is a radical change in our political and moral outlook over the past 50 years. Are you aware that your daughter couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent, but she can have an abortion arranged through that same public school without even your knowledge, much less your consent? That's why I contend that the solution to this moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. Let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. You know, our founding fathers practiced and advocated the Ten Commandments, and they even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. Now, there's still one school left in America that teaches this entire Mosaic Law, that is the Ten Commandments and all 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, as well as the penalties and the benefits, 33 benefits for their observance. You know, every law has a penalty, and you don't have to know what that penalty is to suffer its effect. So whether you call it the Mosaic Law or the Law of God or Common Law or Natural Law or Karma, or something else, it's automatic. It works just like AIDS, herpes, and VD, which just happens to be the natural penalty for adultery. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package? That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. If you're online, just go to the website georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, and then click onto the email machine. Send an email request for that free General Law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about drought, primarily drought here in America. Now, in this last program, let me take you around the world and show you that drought isn't occurring just in the United States. It's occurring all around the world. It's occurring all around the world, and in Matthew 24, there was a prophecy. And I pointed out to you earlier that if somebody, whether it's George Gordon or God or Allah or Buddha or somebody else, came to you and said, I'm going to give you rain in due season if you do A, B, and C for me, whoever made that offer would have to have control of the weather. Now, that's more than the United States government claims. It's more than any government that I know of around the world claims. But there's somebody here in what we call the Christian Bible. It's actually Hebrew, but the Hebrew Bible, the scriptures, who says, I can make it rain on one place and I can dry it up in another. I can give you rain in due season, or I can give you floods. Or I can withhold the rain, and I can destroy you from off the land. And I showed you as we went through a number of stories here about the Anasazis who were destroyed from off the land down in the southwest. It's happened to the Babylonians, the Assyrians. It's happened to the Israelites back in olden times. It's happened to the Mayas and a number of civilizations and peoples around the world. And it's happening right now in modern 21st century America, Canada, Kenya, China, and around the world. Now listen to this. Now, although experts cannot conclusively predict that there are hard times looming, previous patterns indicate that the drought aftermath may be very destructive. Now, this is talking about Kenya. As Kenya attempts to halt the ruinous famine that has claimed lives and almost wiped out sources of livelihood in parts of the country, authorities may well be forewarned of the hard times ahead. The current famine will run into 2007, at least, even as the next rains promise to be phenomenal, and perhaps very destructive. The long rains across the country are expected in late March, just 1 month away. But some meteorologists and food security and resource mapping experts are sounding the alarm. They're drawing parallels between the raging drought and the expected rains. Normally, they caution the severe, the drought, or the more severe, the more disruptive the ensuing rains become. And although we are yet to undertake specific studies on this issue, it is nonetheless obvious that in Kenya, it is always a matter of back-to-back situations. Severe droughts precede heavy rains. We thus expect this situation this time around. But the meteorological people are better placed to comment, said an official at the Regional Center for Mapping of Resources for Development at Kasarani, Nairobi. Now, officials at the Kenya Meteorological Department headquarters in Nairobi are cautious, and they say it's too early to predict the magnitude of the next rains. Thus, until next month when the department forecasts March weather patterns, it remains risky business to speculate on the possibility of floods. For scientific approach, when the situation is very dry, you might get heavy rainfall, says the department's deputy director, William Nakwada, a meteorologist who has studied weather variations over a long period. The March-April rainfall is a challenging season for prediction. Many factors will come into play, and thus complicating the prediction, he notes. The October-November situation is a bit easier to predict because the weather factors will be already stable. And yet what worries weathermen in Kenya is the lack of intelligence into drought-instigated floods, according to an official of USAID-funded FEWS, that's NET, Farming Early Warning System Network. The Kenya Meteorological, let me turn the page here, department and a host of other survey and mapping organizations, including FEWS-NET, are yet to undertake studies to understand this phenomenal linkage. All right, now let me pause here and make an observation. In Bible prophecy, we see God, somebody by the name of God, we call him God, making predictions 3,000 years ago. Not just of the United States, or not just of Israelite countries, but of the world in general. In fact, in Matthew 24, Jesus said that there was coming a time when, if he didn't come back and personally intervene, no flesh would be saved alive on planet Earth. Now, during the Cold War period, as a child growing up, I was one of those that had to go through nuclear drills, you know, nuclear bomb drills, and we'd go duck under our desks, or we'd run out into the halls and kneel down, you know, against a wall, things like that. Because we literally expected the Russians to attack us with nuclear weapons, you know, at some point in time. And we talked about, and Dr. Edward Teller, who is called the father of the hydrogen bomb, said that there is enough nuclear capacity in the world by 1960 to destroy all life from off the planet 13 times over, and that was possessed by the Russians. The Americans, by 1960, had enough nuclear capacity to destroy all life from off the planet 50 times over. And they talked about nuclear winter. All right, so we were familiar, at least at that juncture of our history and existence, that yes, it was possible to destroy all life from off the planet. Now, I don't know if global warming is caused by the burning of fossil fuels, and I'm not sure that anybody else knows that either. I'm sure that it probably is throwing gasoline on the fire, but this thing of El Nino has been going on for a long time. Now, let's suppose that the scientists are correct. And let's suppose that God hasn't had a thing to do with global warming. Now, I already advanced my theory. I thought that it was God that's doing it. Let's suppose, for the sake of our discussion, he hasn't done a thing. Global warming is here, and we're able to measure it. We're now to the point where we can see that global temperatures over the past century have risen by 1 degree. Furthermore, 20% of the Arctic ice cap has already melted past tense, and the Greenland glaciers are melting at the highest rate in recorded history. Right now, today, as I speak, Greenland, the glaciers, the ice cap is melting. Same thing is happening down in Antarctica. Now, the ultimate end to this is no flesh will be saved alive on planet Earth. So whether God is doing it to us, or whether he was smart enough to figure out that about the time of the end, people would be going to and fro, as Daniel told us in Daniel 12, and that technology would get to a point where there would be millions of automobiles burning, you know, tons and tons and millions of tons of oil, spewing greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and warming the planet until, finally, you would have meteorological events such as Hurricane Katrina and droughts that would ultimately destroy all life from off the planet, because that's what this article is aimed at. Not just the famine in Kenya. They're telling us that as the world turns today, if you extrapolate this out into the future, what's going to happen to mankind? In the very best of scenarios, there's going to be a vast dying off of the human population. A vast dying off. Now, the Global 2000 people would like to see the world's population stabilized at about 500 million. Or about 90% less than there is today. That's their goal. That's what they're trying to do. That's what the Global 2000 folks are trying to tell us. That's what they want to sell us. It could well be that besides the Global 2000 people, that there is a God in heaven who has the same idea, because in Isaiah chapter 6, verse 13, I believe it is. Let me look that up just to make sure that I give you the right skinny here. Be patient with me because I'm just a plumber. I'm not a real preacher, you know. Isaiah 6, verse 13, you find that he says, I'm going to save 10% of you people alive. Let's see if that's the right. Yeah, it is. Here it is. But yet in it shall be a tenth, and it shall return and shall be eaten as a teal tree and as an oak, whose substance is in them when they cast their leaves. So the holy seed shall be the substance thereof. Now, as you read this short chapter, there's only 13 verses in chapter 6 there, and you apply the code, you know, Isaiah 28, verses 9 through 13, and you put the story together with Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, Revelation 18, so on. It tells you a little piece of the story, that the ultimate number that God himself has in mind is 10%. So that when the Messiah returns and takes over control of the world, sets up his world government in Jerusalem, and then begins the millennial rule. He's going to start off with about 500 million people, about one-tenth of the Earth's population. Now, in Matthew 24, he made an observation. He said, you know, that this is going to be worse than Noah's flood. Now, I don't know how you can get something worse than Noah's flood when you kill everybody in the world except 8 people. evidently, there are more people living today than there was back in Noah's time. That's just an inference that I draw from it. I didn't come up with that idea. You can go read it yourself. It's in Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21. Those three chapters, you know, the disciples came to him and said, hey, tell us what things are going to be like at the time of the end. Now, I come along on the scene and I say, well, gee, have you been reading any of the current news articles? Have you been reading, you know, or have you heard, have you been on the web lately? Listen to another story here. The UN says that the world, the globe, is drying up at a fast pace. Let's take a look at this one. The United Nations. The world is turning to dust, with lands the size of Rhode Island becoming desert wasteland every year, and the problem threatening to send millions of people fleeing to greener countries, the United Nations says. Just in case you didn't know, Rhode Island is 1,026 square miles. Now, if every year an area the size of Rhode Island, which is the smallest state in the United States, by the way, is being turned to desert, then in 2 years, that's 2,000 square miles. In 10 years, that's 10,000 square miles. In 100 years, that's 100,000 square miles. So every century, a piece of real estate about the size of Montana, which isn't the biggest state, but it's one of the five or six biggest states in the United States, 114,000 square miles, is being turned to desert worldwide every year. 4,000 square miles of the Amazon basin, the Amazon jungle, is being cut down and turned to farmland. 4,000 square miles of forest is being destroyed every year, and that's just in Brazil. Now, you know, as more and more people are born, about 100 million people a year are born, the population, I say born, the population of the world is growing at the rate of about 100 million a year. I think it was 90 million the last time I saw. Now, I don't know how many people are dying every year, but the net gain is about 90 million. Well, my God, boys and girls, every 10 years or 12 or 14 years, the world is adding a billion people. Thousand million. That's a billion. That's as many people as live in China. Every 15 years, we're adding a China or an India to the world's population. Now, you don't have to be real smart to figure out that at some point in time, that has to stop. It's unsustainable growth is what it boils down to. Well, if you think that it's sustainable, why don't you just do the math? You know, every 15 years you're adding 100, or you're adding 1 billion people, 100 million a year, 15. Just carry that out through the 21st century, just business as usual. That gives us 7 billion in addition to the 6 that are already here. That's 13 billion by the end of the 21st century. Now, 13 billion people are going to be multiplying faster than 6 billion. So if 6 billion multiply at the rate of 100 million a year, then wouldn't 13 billion multiply at the rate of 200 million a year? So in the 22nd century, it would only take half as long, 50 years, to double the population from 13 to 26 billion people. Now, that's what we call geometric progression. Well, then in the 23rd century, it would only take 3.5 years, wouldn't it, to double the population from 26 to 52 billion. See where we're going, boys and girls? And then it doubles from 50 billion to 100 billion and so on. Now, the world is a big place, but it's not that big. It's not big enough for 100 billion, 200 billion, 500 billion, 5 trillion. You know, at some point in time, the growth has to stop. And there's going to be people alive, living, doing their thing, when that event or when that time comes. And I suspect that we're about there with 6 billion growing to 7. I suspect that we're about there. And here's why. Desertification is just one more nail in the coffin. Population growth is a second nail in the coffin. And then you've got fiat money, that is economic collapse, coming worldwide, not just in the United States. In the past, it's been, you know, Bolivia or Brazil or Argentina or China or somebody. But now we're facing the entire world's economy collapsing. And so as we put these problems together and we add them up and put them in perspective, and then we measure that with Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 28, Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, Revelation 6, 17, 18, we get a picture. It tells us a story. It says, hey, listen, this is we're approaching the generation. We are the generation that is going to be alive at the second coming. Now, it might not be George Gordon, but some of you listening to my voice right now, today, are going to see it. Now, the world is turning to dust. One-third of the Earth's surface is at risk. One-third of the world is at risk, driving people into cities and destroying agriculture in vast swaths of Africa. 31% of Spain is threatened, while China has already lost 36,000 square miles to desert, an area the size of Indiana, since 1950. Now, Indiana, I think, is about 36,000 square miles, round numbers. 36,000 square miles of real estate. That's 36,000 sections for you farmers and ranchers out there. 36,000 sections now have been turned to desert. We see that same process going on right here in the United States as we pump the Ogla Aquifer dry. Now, there's a big aquifer here that stretches from North Dakota. Hell, it may go up into Canada, I don't know, but it goes down through North and South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, into Texas. It's already dry down at the south end in Texas. And it's already been pumped 80% dry in the other five states. 80% is gone. Now, can you picture all those center pivots out there in Nebraska and Kansas going dry? You know, that produces a lot of grain. That produces a lot of food out there, and, you know, we're mining it. We're mining it. It's like taking a seam of coal. Every time you take a ton of coal out of that seam, it's one ton less. It's not being produced anymore. And so we're drawing the water out of the aquifer faster than it can recharge. Now, you know, at some point in time, as population continues to grow, Americans are now at 300 million, and we expect to double by the year 2050. So here it is, you know, just the beginning of the 21st century, and by 2050 there's going to be 600 million of us. And the 600 million of us in the year 2050 will have no grain, nothing to export. We will be consuming it all right here in the United States. So that's bad news for the rest of the world that today is relying upon American grain exports to feed them today. Now, what are they going to do when we Americans are consuming it all in 45 more years? Now, all you got to do is do the arithmetic, and it tells you that the world is on a collision course with unsustainability, bottom line. And then we get this problem of peak oil. Now, I know you're going to send me an email and tell me that this peak oil is just political diatribe. Well, let's suppose that your theory is correct and that we have not reached peak oil, that in reality there is an unlimited supply of oil that comes from the center of the earth, and that what we're facing here is Mobil or ExxonMobil and the Bush administration, and it's a political problem. Okay, let me grant you that. Now, you tell me, what the hell difference does it make, whether it's a political problem or a physical problem, if there's no gas at the gas station? Or if the price of gas is $5 or $6 or $8 a gallon, which, by the way, for all of you international people out there, I mean, you must look at us Americans over here like we're space cases. gasoline in Great Britain is already pushing $6 a gallon. $6 a gallon, boys and girls. We Americans are paying $2.36 a gallon nationwide. That's the average. And we're just croaking over here in the United States. I mean, we're just having conniption fits. The price of gas is over $2 a gallon. Of course, nobody pays attention to the amount of money that we're printing every year. I mean, we're pouring money out of our printing presses over here just as fast as they can run, which, of course, depreciates the value of our dollars, which brings us closer to the inevitable day of reality when the American dollar is going to collapse. Next week, we'll take a look at economics. Well, I'll take you through the economics that we haven't talked about for the last 6 or 8 weeks. And every week it gets worse. I mean, it's just flat scary. We've got pink money that's in warehouses in Europe. Now, that's shades of a two-tier monetary system. And then last week in the International Forecaster, they pointed out that they're not taking checks now in European banks. They've stopped taking checks, American checks, because they're afraid they're not going to get paid. Devaluation is coming. Everybody's getting ready for devaluation in Europe. Americans don't even know what devaluation is, much less whether it's coming to America or not. And in Switzerland, they figure that the devaluation is going to be around 50%. Now, that's just the tip of the iceberg. That's the economic problem coming up. And then America isn't going to cease to exist because of an economic collapse. But there's going to be a massive transfer of property from people that can't pay for it to people who hold the mortgage on it. So if you've got a house with a mortgage, you're going to have some problems coming up. Now, this week, the United Nations marks the 10th anniversary of the Convention to Combat Desertification. It's a plan aimed at stopping the phenomenon. Despite the efforts, the trend seems to be picking up speed, doubling its pace since the 1970s. It's a creeping catastrophe, said Michael Smitall. He's a spokesman for the United Nations Secretariat that oversees the 1994 Accord. Entire parts of the world might become uninhabitable. Slash and burn agriculture, sloppy conservation, overtaxed water supplies, and soaring populations are mostly to blame. But global warming is taking its toll also. Now let's just run through this again. Let's get your fingers up here. Let's take a look at number one. He says that entire parts of the world might become uninhabitable. Slash and burn agriculture, that's that 4,000 square miles of real estate that's being, or forest that's being knocked down in Brazil. And that doesn't count the Congo and other places in the world. That's just one place, one country, that practices slash and burn, and they're knocking down 4,000. Put up one finger. Sloppy conservation. God told us to dress and keep the garden. Sloppy conservation number two. Overtaxed water supplies. Remember the Ogla Ogla aquifer? Shucks, boys and girls, that's just one aquifer. Hell, all the aquifers around the world are being taxed. So let's put up number three. And then soaring population, 100 million people a year. Let's put up finger number four. But global warming is taking its toll, too. So let's put global warming on here. Global warming that we can observe. And by the way, this global warming is going to raise sea levels. I don't know exactly how much. You know, one guy tells you one number, another guy tells you another number. But if you melt the ice off of Greenland and Antarctica and off the North Pole, you know, it's gonna make coastal property around Florida a little further inland, don't you think? I mean, it's not going to flood all of Florida, but it's going to flood a lot of it. And then all of the coastal communities around the world, and most of the people of the world live around the seacoast. Did you know that? And they're talking about 3 feet. And I've seen some numbers as high as 6 feet. But, you know, let's just take the minimum number, 3 feet. Just raise the water level 3 feet around the world. And that's gonna cost you some land. Now, somebody's going to say, well, my God, we'll get the whole Antarctic continent. But wait. It's still just as cold down there in Antarctica, and just as inhospitable. After you melt the ice off, then what you have is a cold desert instead of a hot desert. Greenland is so far north, what are you going to do? Go up there and start growing bananas? Did you think that you're going to start growing papayas and bananas in Antarctica when the ice sheet melts off? And just because the world warms up by 1 or 2 degrees, so Antarctica, instead of being 30 below zero, will only be 28 below zero. Greenland, which is, averages maybe 20 below zero, is going to be a warm, toasty 18 below zero. It's still not conducive to growing bananas. Hang on, I got to give you a reminder here. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archive. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our webpage, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Tonight's program, we're talking about drought in America, but it goes further than America. Drought's going on all around the world. And in fact, it's not only going on around the world, it's slash and burn agriculture, sloppy conservation, overtaxed water supply, soaring populations, and global warming are also taking their toll. The United Nations is holding a ceremony in Bonn, Germany, to mark World Day to combat desertification, and will hold a meeting in Brazil this month to take stock of the problem. The warning comes as a controversial movie, The Day After Tomorrow, is whipping up interest in climate change, and as rivers and lakes dry up in the American West, giving Americans a taste of what's to come elsewhere. Now, the United Nations says that from the mid-1990s to 2000, 1,374 square miles have turned into deserts each year. It's an area about the size of Rhode Island. That's up from 840 square miles in the 1980s and 624 square miles a year during the 1970s. By 2025, two-thirds of arable land in Africa will disappear, along with one-third of Asia's and one-fifth of South America's. Some 135 million people, that's equivalent to the population of France and Germany combined, are at risk of being displaced. All right, now that's by the year 2025. Boys and girls, we're not talking about 20 years. The period of time from 1985 to 2005 is 20 years. I can think back to 1985. I was in Boise, Idaho, operating Barrister's Inn. Some of you probably listening to me right now can remember Barrister's Inn in Boise 20 years ago. Remember that? 20 years from now, that's what they're talking about here. The people that live in Germany and France, or the equivalent of that number of people, are going to be displaced by desertification in just the next 20 years. What do you think of that? So when Jesus said, you know, that there's a time coming when no flesh would be saved alive on planet Earth, he wasn't whistling Dixie through a straw hat. And as you take a look at the problems that the world faces, not just the United States, but the entire world, and you take a look at drought and desertification, that's just one problem. It's not the only problem, it's just one of many that are all leading to a catastrophe. A catastrophe. Now, I know people will say, well, you know, Gordon Malthus said that the world would be overpopulated in 100 years or so, and or 200, and that we had to have population control. Hell, that was in 1750. Okay, hang on a second. Hang on a minute. In 1750, the population of the world was around 1 billion people, and Malthus came along and he said, well, it looks like to me that population grows geometrically, and that there's coming a time when there won't be enough land, or there will be too many people and not enough food. And Malthus was 100% right about the fact that people would ultimately, at some point in time, they would outstrip the capacity of planet Earth to provide for them. Now, we see this down in the various islands, you know, where sailors would go by and they would drop off goats, you know, so that the next trip through, you know, they could come back to that island and they would eat the goats. Well, they found out that the goats destroyed the vegetation on the island. And then pretty soon the goat population gets so high for the existing vegetation on the island that the goat population decreases. You can have 100 goats and then pretty soon, doesn't kill them all. Some of them survive, but the population may be 100, 200, or 300 on this island. All of a sudden the population collapses because they starve to death and it goes down to 5 or 10. And the 5 or 10 will multiply and over a period of time. And these are collapsing populations. You see it out in the desert. You know, you'll be driving your truck through the desert and 1 year you'll see jackrabbits crossing the road constantly. Just, you know, every mile there'll be a jackrabbit. And then you'll be, you know, 3 or 4 years later or next year you go by and you won't see a jackrabbit anywhere. One once in a great while. And what happens is that the population grows to where it can no longer sustain itself, and then there's a great dying off. Malthus was correct in his arithmetic. He was incorrect in the time frame. He thought that it was going to occur in his lifetime. It didn't. It hasn't. But now, instead of 1 billion people, you've got 6. Well, okay. Now we know that Malthus was incorrect. The world could handle 2 billion. The world could handle 4 billion. And hell, it might be able to handle 8 billion. All right, now when it doubles again from 8 to 16, what do you think about that one? And when it doubles again from 16 to 32, and 32 to 64, and 64 to 128 billion, boys and girls, I'm telling you, there's a point in time here when the world cannot support that many people. I mean, it's common sense. Now, if you think it can, you just get after it, and you just keep believing that way. Well, you're not going to change anything one way or the other, neither am I. But you might want to prepare for the inevitable collapse so that it would give you a better shot at being one of the survivors while the rest of the population dies off. I mean, that ought to motivate you. You might want to be one of the survivors instead of one of the victims. Now, the United Nations says that from the mid-1990s to 2000, 1,374 square miles have turned into deserts each year. 1,374. Now, I said it was 1,026. They said an area about the size of Rhode Island. It's actually a little bigger than Rhode Island, 1,374 square miles. By 2025, two-thirds of the arable land in Africa is going to disappear. Arable land, that's the land you can plant corn on. Two-thirds is disappearing. Let me tell you a little story. Take a look at the north, at Africa, and take a look at the north of Africa, the Sahara Desert. The Sahara Desert's a little bigger than 3 million square miles. In fact, I think it's around 3.5 million, about the size of the United States. 2,000 years ago, the Romans were using North Africa with their slash-and-burn agriculture, cutting the forest down in the what today is the desert. They were growing grain out there. It was the breadbasket of the world. And they went in there, and they used the same kind of farming practices, slash-and-burn, that we're using today, and they destroyed 3.5 million square miles. And the Sahara Desert is growing at the rate, last time I saw, 100 square miles a year. 1,000 square miles every decade. Now, the United Nations says in the next 20 years, they're going to lose about two-thirds of the arable land in Africa. One-third of the arable land in Asia. And a fifth of the arable land, that's 20%, down in South America. Now, wait a minute, boys and girls. The population in Africa, Asia, and South America is still growing. And you're going to take away 20%, 33%, 67% of the arable land in these regions, and you're going to support the population? Boys and girls, it looks like to me that the irresistible force is approaching the immovable object. Doesn't it to you? Most at risk are dry regions on the edges of the deserts, places like sub-Saharan Africa or the Gobi Desert in China, where people are already struggling to eke out a living from the land. And as populations expand, those regions have become more stressed. Trees are cut for firewood. Grasslands are overgrazed. Fields are overfarmed and they lose their nutrients. Water becomes scarcer and dirtier. Technology can make the problems worse. And in parts of Australia, irrigation systems are pumping up salty water and then slowly poisoning the farms. In Saudi Arabia, herdsmen can use water trucks instead of taking their animals from oasis to oasis. But by staying in one place, the herds are getting bigger and eating all the grass. In Spain, Portugal, Italy, and Greece, coastal resorts are swallowing up water that once moistened the wilderness. Many farmers in those countries still flood their fields instead of using more miserly drip irrigation, and the resulting shortages are slowly baking the life out of the land. The result is a patchy rash of dead areas, rather than an easy-to-see expansion of existing deserts, scientists say. These areas have their good times and bad times as the weather changes. But in general, they're getting bigger and worse off. It's not as dramatic as a flood or a big disaster like an earthquake, said Richard Thomas of the International Center for Agricultural Research in the dry areas in Aleppo, Syria. There are some bright spots and hot spots, but overall there is a trend toward increasing degradation. The trend is speeding up, but it has been going on for centuries, scientists say. Fossilized pollen and seeds, along with ancient tools like grinding stones, show that much of the Middle East, the Mediterranean, and North Africa were once green. The Sahara itself was a savanna. And rock paintings in the Sahara today show giraffes, elephants, and cows once lived there. Global warming contributes to the problem, making many dry areas drier, scientists say. And in the last century, average temperatures have risen over 1 degree Fahrenheit worldwide, according to the U.S. Global Change Research Program. And as for the American Southwest, it is too early to tell whether its six-year drought could turn to something more permanent. But scientists note that reservoir levels are dropping as cities like Phoenix and Las Vegas expand. So, let me pause right here and point out, we've discussed this already, but here's two big metropolitan areas, Phoenix and Las Vegas, multi-million population cities. And they're still growing. And at some point, Phoenix is going to be twice as big as it is today, and so is Las Vegas. And they're going to use twice as much water. You've already got a shortage of water. What the hell are you going to do when you have to have twice as much? You know, normally, if you've got a shortage coming up, you use less and less, don't you? No, not with expanding populations. You've got to have more and more. Now, whether God is causing this or whether we're doing this to ourselves, it's really kind of a moot point. It's happening. And we've got to take some kind of evasive action. And when we get to Bible prophecy, we find that there's a great dying off coming. And unless you want to be one of those victims that are dying off, then you need to take some kind of evasive action. And it doesn't seem like to me that moving to Las Vegas or Phoenix is going to solve your problem. It seems like to me you want to move to some spot, someplace, where you're going to have water. Or at least you think you're going to have water. And that maybe you've got a food supply stocked up, because, you know, as food supplies become scarcer and scarcer, you might have a hard time finding food, even if you've got lots of money. The theory, of course, behind the gold bugs, you know, they buy a lot of gold, and my broker told me not too long ago, he said, you know, gold has always been the money of last resort. Always has and always will be. The guy that has the gold will be able to buy anything that he wants. And I'm sure that's true. I'm sure that's true. But you're going to have a hard time convincing me to part with a pound of pinto beans for an ounce of gold if I can't replace my 1 pound of pinto beans. Because you can't eat the gold and neither can I. But both of us can eat the pinto beans. And that's exactly what the United Nations is telling us. You know, you got 6 billion competing mouths all after the same pound of pinto beans. And you're liable to find some people get a little violent trying to take them away from you. Now, in some respects, you may have greener vegetation showing up in people's yards, but you may be using water that was destined for the natural environment, said Stuart Marsh of the University of Arizona's Office of Arid Land Studies. And that might have an effect on the biodiversity surrounding that city. Hang on. All right, so if you've got rainfall, and the rainfall is destined for the soil so that it will water the plants around it. And let's suppose that we collect that water off of the roof, run it into our cistern, and then we use that water in the house, flush it down the sewer and goes off to somewhere. That's going to affect the immediate ecology around your yard. Same thing is true in desert areas around the world. You know, when you're collecting water into giant reservoirs and you take the water out of the reservoirs and you use them to irrigate lawns in Las Vegas, then you have less water to irrigate alfalfa fields, to grow alfalfa to feed dairy cows, so that you can milk the cows and put milk into the supermarket. You know, unless you can use the water 2 or 3 times, and down in Phoenix they're doing that, they're taking wastewater, and they're using that wastewater to irrigate the golf courses. Now, that makes all the sense in the world, you know, in an emergency circumstance, such as a drought, to get the most use out of the water that you can, and that's good. But again, at some point in time, you're going to use up all the wastewater for irrigating golf courses, and irrigating golf courses doesn't produce alfalfa to feed to the cows to produce milk. Seems like to me that the wastewater would be better served or better used if you were growing something or doing something more constructive. It seems like to me that a drought is a serious event. And that a serious event ought to be taken seriously, and that you ought not to be spending your valuable time playing games when there's this emergency. I don't know, it's just me, I guess. Although the Romans went to their circuses and they were playing their games as their empire was disintegrating around them, I see we Americans over here much more concerned about Super Bowl Sunday and the outcome of the World Series and playing golf than we are about combating the drought or solving the drought problem or the desertification problem, whether it's here in America or someplace else in the world. And keep in mind that desertification around the world is going to impact upon the world's economy. And the United States of America is a member of the world economy. And it's going to affect us here in America. It's going to affect you in Spokane, Washington, Seattle, Washington, and in Miami, Florida, and Portland, Maine. It'll affect all of us. Just like Hurricane Katrina, it really affected the people on the Gulf Coast. But hell, it's affecting all of us. We're all paying taxes, and we're all paying for the damage and the rebuilding of that's going on down there along the Gulf Coast. And when another acre of desert is created in the Gobi Desert, it takes another acre out of production, and it puts the people of China into the marketplace, bidding up the price of food, which is going to make it more expensive for you in Seattle. Now, that's what an acre of lost soil in the Gobi Desert has to do with you people in Seattle. It's going to raise your food price because the people in China are willing to pay more money now for that same amount of food. And the guy that's producing it says, well, gee, why should I sell it to a guy in Seattle for 30 cents a pound when the guy in China will pay me 35 cents a pound? Now, it's only a nickel, but boys and girls, nickels add up. Now, in some respects, you may have greener vegetation showing up in people's yards and on the golf courses. But I would contend that you'd be better served if you used that water more judiciously. The Global Change Research Program says global warming could eventually make the Southwest wetter, but it will also cause more extreme weather, meaning harsher droughts that could kill vegetation. Now, the Southwest drought has become so severe that even the sagebrush is dying. Sagebrush. Hey, boys and girls, that's pretty damn severe. When the desert plants start dying, you know it's dry. Now, the lack of water and the overuse of water that's going to be a threat to the United States, said Thomas. In other parts of the world, the problem is poverty that causes people to overuse the land. Most of these ecological systems have tipping points, and once you go past them, things go downhill very rapidly. Now, why is it so dry? What's causing the weather around the world to be so dry? Five causes, remember? Slash and burn, overpopulation. In other words, it's been going on for a long time. It's going on today, and it's going to continue to go on into the future, which means that there's going to be a vast dying off, whether Jesus is here or not. There's going to be a vast dying off. And if you want to live long enough to see the second coming, then you need to survive each and every one of these events. Now, the larder is almost bare. After four consecutive meager harvests, the result of heat waves, droughts, and pestilence, the world stockpile of grain is perilously low. And it's a harbinger of gastronomical Armageddon. Each year around this time, farmers across the breadbaskets of the Northern Hemisphere hop on their tractors and drive out to their fields full of hope for the new season's grain crop. And for the past 4 years, their efforts haven't been too successful. Each year, it has been an almost unprecedented run of misfortune. Four back-to-back meager harvests. Not that we're not getting any harvests, just low harvests. As heat waves, drought, and pestilence take their toll, something that hasn't happened since at least 1960. Now, as a result, since the turn of the new millennium, the amount of grain held in the world stockpiles has been falling. At the end of 2003's harvest, the amount of wheat, corn, rice, and other grains had fallen to about 280 million tons. In 1999, it was more than 500 million tons. So it's down by 40%. Now, how many days supply is that? It's less than 38 days supply worldwide. You know, the world is living on the ragged edge of a massive famine. Have you thought about that? You know, boys and girls, we live from year to year. I know you go to the supermarket every day or once a week, at least every week, and it's always got wheat there. It's always got flour. It's always got sugar there. And you buy it. But when you take a look at wheat, it only is produced once a year. It comes out, you know, once a year wheat is produced. You get a crop, you know, you plant it and it grows, and a year later you harvest it. And when that crop grows once a year, you have to get enough at harvest time to last you for 11 more months. That's the bottom line. Now, fortunately, there's companies out there, you know, like Pillsbury and Archer Daniels Midland, and they take the grain and they stockpile it for you. Boys and girls, don't you think you'd be better served if you had your own stockpile of wheat, sugar, jelly, jams, flour, etc.? Because you're down to less than a 38-day supply worldwide. Boy, that could bid up the price of foodstuffs pretty dramatically if there's any major shift. And we just haven't seen that major shift yet, have we? Let me suggest to you that you get the Fedco seed catalog. Not only do you need food, but you need good food. And genetically modified organisms is not good food. And from time to time, when I run across a seed company that's still producing or still selling open pollinated seed, I always recommend them. And the latest one is called Fedco Seeds. They're at Post Office Box 520 in Waterville, Maine. Fedco Seeds, P.O. Box 520, Waterville, Maine. The zip code up there is 04903. Again, that's 04903. Now, they've also got a phone number, 207-873-7333. That's 207-873-7333. May come in handy for you one of these days. You may come to a point where you'll be planting seeds to support yourself. And I always recommend that everybody have a 4-year supply of food and a 4-year supply of seeds to maintain your 4-year supply of food. We used to do that here in America. We used to carry a surplus, so that if there was a bad harvest next year, we had enough to carry us through that bad harvest next year to the following year. That's a 2-year supply. Once every 3 years, you have to have a supply to carry you through the third year harvest. And then once every 7 years, you have to have a 3-year supply to carry you through the land Sabbath year. Once every 50 years, you got to have a 4-year supply to carry you through the land Sabbath and the Jubilee, and to have a 1-year supply. You know, we used to, and it was common practice, to have a food storage program. Might not be a bad idea right now. Hey, I'm about out of time. We'll have to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Let me give you a final reminder that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard 7 days a week worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.